Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the Providence Journal's College Basketball Podcast. This is Bill Koch, sports writer for the Journal, in our downtown studios in Providence. It's a Friday afternoon as we record this latest edition of the pod. I'm joined here in studio by the sports director at ABC6 and the weekend co-host of Cordishi and Coit on WEI Providence, Nick Coit, ladies and gentlemen. Coity, how are we living?
We're living okay, Bill. We're living okay. This is an interesting time because we've got all the college basketball stuff going on, but we've got this interesting crossover because of COVID-19. My mind is racing with high school football tonight and
yeah, that's right.
Preparing for all that around here, but it's fun. There's no shortage of things to do and stuff to talk about.
Yeah, college football as well. Big game coming up Saturday for the Rhodey Rams against Delaware.
Unbelievable start for the season for them, right?
Two nationally ranked teams going at it in Kingston Saturday. I think it's a noon kick, correct?
I believe so, yeah.
Who would have thought that in March we'd be talking about college football? But here we are in this unprecedented year plus of our lives where we are discussing an NCAA tournament being played in front of limited fans, a season that was played in front of limited or no fans. And honestly, just grateful that we're here, grateful that we're doing this and that we do have games to talk about, and that our local teams, are still active on the transfer wire. We'll get into that. The transfer portal now up over 900 names, and there has been activity at all four of our men's programs in the state. We'll start with the last men's team to play a game in the state this year, and that was Bryant. They played on Monday at the CBI, lost to Coastal Carolina 93-82, a game that the Chanticleers just jumped out early, went on a big run early in the first half. Bryant was down by double digits for most of the final 31 minutes in that game. Just could never really get going in terms of getting enough stops, in terms of making a real run to cut into the deficit. Chris Childs finished with 24 points. He led four in double figures for the Bulldogs. Bryant, their second ever trip to the postseason in Division I. They end the season at 15-7. Coity, I was a little surprised that they ended up playing this game. It was sort of after the fact. After they lost the Northeast Conference Championship game, we found out that they would be in the CBI. A game that I don't think was really reflective of the season that Bryant had overall.
No, I don't think so. And clearly this was a... And Jared Grosso said as much. This was a decision by the players. They wanted to play. But I don't think it was... I don't want to say they weren't fully locked in. But at the same time, I think that they sort of took their shot. And, it wasn't one of those they're walking off the court and they're all heartbroken that they lost a game. It was a good experience for them. And I think the bigger goals in mind are to come back next season and have another great year and try to get over the hump in the NEC and get to the NCAA tournament. So getting to play, I think for them was good. Again, it was a player's decision, but I just can't help but think Hall, I love him as a player, but when Hall Elijah's taking 3-point shots and taking multiple in the first half, I'm saying,
yeah.
I don't know, Bill.
Yeah, what's going on here?
Yeah, right.
For me, I respect the player's decision to play. I respect the coaching staff for listening to the players. What I wish would have happened is that the NCAA would have taken action and just canceled all the tournaments aside from the NCAA tournament this year. That's the one that has real meaning. You're playing for a national championship. You're not playing for an NIT or CBI or CIT championship. You are playing for a true national championship. In my mind, the other tournaments are there for some exposure. They're there for some postseason experience. They're also there to fill television slots and make money. And if there was ever a time that the NCAA might have taken a half step back away from their naked greed, it might have been this year. And what ends up happening is Bryant's players are forced to stay in COVID protocols for an extra 2 weeks, just to play in the CBI. For me, is the juice worth the squeeze in that way? For me, the answer is no. And that is not a criticism of Bryant, of their program, of their coaches, of their players. I understand that those were their wishes. I respect those. What I wish is that the NCAA had taken the decision out of their hands.
Sure. Yeah, it's tough to say with some of the smaller tournaments this year that it was, in the best interest of sort of exposure and whatnot. I get that these teams and programs want to have that, postseason exposure itself. But, at the same time, this year of all years, it's tough to sell, I guess. But, look, Bryant wanted to play. They had the option to play.
Right.
So, they went out and played and, that's a good thing, and any experience I think is good experience. But again, I think for them, I think the biggest goal that they had was to get to the NCAA tournament. Obviously, unfortunately, fell short of that. But I think they're locked in on next season. So yeah, good to get that sort of experience, play a team from a different place, from a different area. But I think the focus definitely for the coaching staff is, okay, how do we improve this team in the offseason? And, how do we improve so that next year we can get over that hump?
Bryant's already off to a head start in that regard. They have two commits already from older players. Adam Alita, who's a wing shooter from Northern Kentucky, has committed to the Bulldogs. Greg Calixt, who's a big man for George Mason. URI fans have watched him for the last 4 years. He committed to Bryant on Friday morning. Alita was somebody who they recruited out of the junior college ranks. I think he started his career at Idaho. Calixt was a guy who was recruited by Jared Grasso while Jared was on staff at Iona. Calixt is a Mount Vernon, New York kid, which is right in Iona's backyard. Had a pretty good list coming out of high school. He's a traditional big guy, 6'9", has never taken a three-pointer in his career, shoots 60% from the field. He's the type of guy who matchup-wise would have helped the Bulldogs in that NEC final against Mount St. Mary's when they got overwhelmed a little bit inside.
I thought the same thing when I heard his name today, and I sort of looked him up and said, okay, skill set-wise, what does he bring? I can't help but think that the Bryant staff looked at that Mount St. Mary's game and said, I think we know something that we could probably use, because we have one good big in Hall Elishas, but other than that, we could definitely use some more to... Because Mount St. Mary's proved to be a tough matchup for them in that regard. So they want to be able to go up against different types of teams, and so to add a guy like Calix is... That's a good thing. You need a little more size, and they're already addressing it.
Yep, it's a good move for Bryant to bring in more experience. We both think that they're going to be among the NEC favorites next year and contenders to be in the NCAA tournament. And this is common in college basketball now. There will be players on the move. We've seen that at Providence. There have been four significant decisions that will affect the Friars next season. Let's start with the good for PC. Nate Watson is staying. He has exercised his right to stay for a fifth year. The NCAA has granted all student athletes a blanket waiver to play an extra year, seniors or not. It could be any year in college due to COVID-19 and the unusual circumstances that folks have experienced over the last year. So with Nate Watson making that decision, PC brings back its leading scorer, its leading rebounder, a guy who says he wants to lead the Big East in field goal shooting and block shots next season, someone who's going to be very motivated after having a very strong fourth season with the Friars. Coity, I think if you looked at Providence's roster, the front court, if Nate Watson had decided to leave and was still waiting on a decision from Noah Horkler, but if both of those guys had decided to go, would have been a massive hole in the paint for the Friars.
Big time. Big time. So this is huge. And to have a player of Nate's caliber and experience, it gives you another shot here. It gives you another shot next year to make the type of run that I think they envisioned and wanted to make in the Big East this year. Obviously, things didn't go the way that they planned. So, bring it back. And if Nate's back with Noah and with David Duke, they're going to have that opportunity. And they're already making the roster tweaks around those guys and with those guys to, you know, sort of say, okay, where can we, you know, where can we improve? Where can we get better? Who can we add to help these guys so that they can come back and be, you know, a team in the top half of the Big East next year?
Yeah, four potential starters returning for Providence, obviously with A.J. Reeves as well. You know, the Friars are they're going to lose some peripheral pieces here. You know, one of those, the latest on Thursday, Jimmy Nichols has decided that he will leave Providence after three seasons. Did not play the last nine games this year due to an undisclosed illness. Noah Horkler stepped into the starting lineup in that time and was really good. He averaged 11.3 points and 8.7 rebounds in nine games. You wonder if there was a discussion there between Jimmy Nichols and Ed Cooley about who his starter would be at the four next season. You wonder if Jimmy Nichols maybe, you know, didn't like what he was hearing in that discussion and decided that he'd like to go somewhere where he would be a starter next season. He did start in 27 of his 51 career games with Providence, including 8 of 16 last year. You know, and that just brings the Friars even further into the transfer market next year. They now have four open scholarships. Jimmy Nichols, Chris Monroe, Greg Gant, all leaving. Providence had one open scholarship already. You have Legend Jeter and Rafael Castro coming in. But Providence is going to be very active in terms of guys who they're looking at. You know, some of the names out there, guys like Earl Timberlake, who they recruited heavily out of the Washington, D.C. area. He spent 1 year at Miami, is going to leave. Odis Toney, who was a really good player at Pittsburgh, somebody who Providence recruited previously, you know, was one of the top scorers in the ACC. He's on the market. They're looking at several guards. Antonio Day Jr. from Florida International, Aljamie Durham from Indiana, Bobby Pettiford Jr., who was an incoming freshman. He was a commit to Louisville. The Cardinal made some staff changes. One of those was they fired assistant coach Dino Gaudio. They opted not to renew his contract. Dino Gaudio recruits North Carolina. He's a former Wake Forest coach. He was the guy who led the recruitment on Bobby Pettiford. Pettiford's a consensus top 120 recruit. Also had offers from Virginia Tech, Mississippi, and others. He'd be a real good get this late in the cycle for Providence. But I guess, you know, what we're sort of getting at here is this is the sort of thing that you're going to expect to see after seasons now. It's much more than just looking at transfers and just looking at junior college players who are uncommitted. You know, you're going to have to worry about re-recruiting your own roster as well. And I think, you know, Ed Cooley is in the beginning stages of doing that as he sets up for 21-22.
This job is a lot tougher for these college coaches now, even at a big program like Providence. Yeah, you just going through all the names, it makes your head spin. And that was just a few names that we just brought up for one program.
That's right.
You know, think about some of the things that some of these other programs have to go through, the mid-majors, you know, and how they have to basically re-recruit their kids every year because they're going to get tempted by some of the power programs. So Pettiford would be a freshman, correct?
Yes.
Okay. It sounded like before, you know, before he committed to Louisville, that Providence was basically, it was between Louisville and Providence. That's what it sounded like.
They were on the final list. Yeah.
And Ed Cooley, I've read a little bit about it, you know, has a good relationship with his dad, and, you know, he's talking to Bobby every day. So that really would be a really nice get. I think it'd sort of be, you know, one of your guys that you're going to build sort of the next wave of Friar basketball around if you were to get him, a four-star guy. And in the transfer market, yeah, in terms of Jimmy, you know, I think it's a shame because I think Jimmy actually was starting to make a leap this year, especially defensively for the Friars. You know, he goes down with the illness, and I'm sure that sort of in his head, too, made him, you know, seem like, okay, well, I can play at a really high level, and, you know, if Noah is going to come back, you know, maybe it is it's a good, honest conversation if Ed and Jimmy sat down and said, look, I'm bringing Noah back, and, you know, you may not get the sort of role that we envision for you, whatever. And
so we'd love to have you.
Right, exactly.
But.
Right. Right. And those are the sorts of honest conversations that are good for player and good for, I think, program. It's healthy.
Agreed.
It's healthy to
yes,
have those.
I agree.
So, you know, seeing Jimmy go, I hate to see it because I felt like he was making a leap this year. You know, it's funny you bring up all the games that he started. You remember how many games he started his freshman year? I think it was 18 games freshman year.
He started, I think it was the fourth or fifth game of his career. He replaced Isaiah Jackson in the starting lineup very early.
Yeah, it was very, it was strange. But that year, he was a freshman. That was sort of, I guess he was sort of raw at that point. They were still trying to develop him a little bit.
I actually felt like, and I've said this before on the pod, I felt like Ed Cooley mismanaged his team a little bit that year.
Okay.
He brought Jimmy Nichols in really early after Isaiah Jackson had played reasonably well.
Yeah.
Jimmy Nichols struggled.
He
had to go back to Isaiah Jackson like the 20th, 21st game or so. And Jimmy Nichols really struggled down the stretch. You could see that being demoted to the bench hurt his confidence.
Sure.
As a freshman, it's difficult to deal with that sort of thing. You're not as mature. You're not as experienced as you might be in college basketball. You know, you don't necessarily understand that if you are sent from the starters to the bench, that is meant to be motivation to work harder. To grind more, to be more determined. And I think a lot of kids in that situation, naturally, I would as well, think, well, the coach doesn't like me anymore.
Yeah, right.
I'm not a good player anymore.
Especially a freshman.
It's difficult to take. You know, so I thought that was curious at the time, the way Ed managed his minutes freshman year. I thought he had carved out a role as a junior.
Absolutely, 100%. You know,
clearly had found his place on this team. I think if they do make some of the offensive tweaks that we've talked about before in terms of playing a little more pace, playing a little more in the open floor, I think those would have benefited his skill set immensely. You know, unfortunately, though, for Friar fans, we're just not going to get to see that happen.
Sure. Yeah, and I agree. His junior year was a different player, different time. And that's why, again, I listen to the news and I'm like, oh, man, you know, he really could be he'll be a good player, I think, for somebody. You know, it's a shame it's not going to happen here, but, you know, it is what it is. This is sort of the nature of this thing now. And, I think if the Friars could, if they could land somebody like Pettiford and then, you know, get a couple of guys on the transfer market that you feel like you can, you know, that can help you, whether it's Tony or whether it's, you know, somebody else. You know, I think you'll be in business. It's just, it's tweaking the roster around the guys that you already have now because you are bringing back some experienced guys that have been in your program.
Home run for the Friars, in my mind, would be an experienced guy who can shoot it a little bit, and then a freshman like Pettiford, who's a developmental guard, you know, someone who could play as David Duke goes to the NBA, as AJ Reeves graduates or gets into his fifth year.
Would you say, like, Day would be a guy that would be an experienced? You know, I've looked at his shooting numbers, but...
He could score.
Okay.
You know, his assist to turnover is pretty much one-to-one, so he's not necessarily somebody that you would trust playing the point, I wouldn't say. He is a scorer. You know, in terms of the guys that they were looking at, Steph Smith, who just committed to St. John's this morning, he's a good shooter.
Yeah.
You know, there are some other guys who you're looking at a little more size, like Timberlake is 6'6", super athletic. Somebody who was on NBA draft boards is potentially a one-and-done guy.
Yeah.
You know, was injured throughout his freshman year at Miami, didn't really play as much as you might have thought. But the evaluation, the fact that he's a consensus top 50 recruit, a big-time talent, you would trust what your eyes saw earlier. You would love to have the chance to work with that sort of moldable clay.
Yeah.
You know, so that's certainly, you know, something that Providence would be open to, would like very much. And that those sorts of discussions are being had in basketball offices throughout the state, throughout the country. They're going on in Kingston as well. We have movement from two guards there. Both mild surprises, I thought. Fats Russell opting to enter the transfer portal. He will take a fifth year as a graduate transfer and will have no shortage of Power 5 and Big East suitors. Jeremy Shepard opting to stay in Kingston. He will not pursue a professional future. Despite being honored at senior night, he will be a member of the Rams in 2021-22. He will be their leading returning scorer. Coity, I was mildly surprised by both of those things.
Me too. I think the surprise more came with the Fats move.
Agreed.
But I was pleasantly surprised with Jeremy Shepard too, because I think you and I have talked about off the mic here that we felt like he could get professional opportunities in different places. But you know, for URI, it's great news because I think we've talked about previously, Bill, what's URI going to need next year? Well, I think they're going to need somebody like Jeremy Shepard. Well, hey, what's better than having Jeremy Shepard back, right? So having it back, yes, it's a great thing for them. You know, he'll slide into his role again. I think he'll help with the transition. I envision him and Ish Leggett both together as guards in the starting five next year.
Mm-hmm.
So having him back, you know, a guy that now he gets to play another year in this program. And that's intriguing to me because he only played for 1 year for the Rams. And so
Right. Now
he's an experienced guy, a guy that's been around for a season, and you know he's obviously a good shooter, a guy that can score, second leading scorer. So yeah, I think it's a great thing to have him back. In terms of Fats, he's not going to have a shortage of offers for sure.
No.
And I think for him, you know, thinking about it, I was surprised when I saw it, but at the same time I looked at it and I said his senior year riddled with injuries, he had to be the number one option, but obviously with the injuries that made things difficult. So go to a power program where you have other, you know, high-end talent around you. They'll highlight some of your strengths. You'll get to be in a situation like you were a couple of years ago when it was you with Jeff Doughton and Cyril Langevin, except you're going to have more of those sorts of guys around you in a power program.
That's right.
And you don't have to do it all yourself. And I think that would really, that'll highlight Fats and his strengths again. It'll get his stock back up. And when Fats is playing at a high level, he's All-American caliber. So if he finds the right spot, you know, I think Scott Cordish and I were talking about maybe, you know, if Mike Smith is done at Michigan after this year, the Columbia guy, does he go to Michigan? Like, could that be a place? I think it's on his list. Another place that it was, I mean, I think this is fairly obvious, but it wasn't on his list, and I was kind of surprised. The next state over, and it's UConn.
Yeah.
That one was surprising that it wasn't on his list.
Yeah.
I'm sure he talked to somebody over there. It probably, I'm going to guess, a guy whose name rhymes with Han Durley. You know, I mean, that's what I'm thinking.
Knows him a little bit.
Yeah. But not on his list, which was interesting to me.
Yeah, it was, you know, if we've seen anything over Fats, out of Fats in his 4 years in Kingston, it's that he embraces the stage like few others.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that stage with the full arena, whether it's at home or on the road, that energy that he can play with, that fuels him. I don't think that a Power 5 or a Big East program would be too big for him in that way. I think his game can be adapted to the point where he could play very well in a system like that, where he doesn't have to do everything, where he's not the number one option, you know, where he has guys who he can share the ball with, you know, bigs who can protect him a little bit. In terms of Shepard coming back, he's the best three-point shooter on the roster last year, 39.4% from deep. His last seven games was really good as a facilitator, 23 assists and only 2 turnovers.
Wow.
So you put the ball in his hands primarily, you would think, alongside Ish Leggett. And you've got 4 potential returning starters there with Malik Barton and with Mikel Mitchell. Those 4 guys were starters against Duquesne in their regular season finale. So you're going to have no shortage of experience at URI. You certainly think that they would be in the market for more perimeter scoring. I still think that they could use some guard help. Depending on what you believe, they've been in contact with several players in that way. Ball State transfer Ishmael El-Amin, who is a Minnesota native. Jared West, who is a Marshall grad transfer, who has a really impressive list, would be a really good get for URI. Shot 40% from 3 last year. He's a 2-time Conference USA All-Defensive Team player. Greg Parham, who's a big-time scorer out of VMI, knows Jeremy Shepard. He's a Richmond native, 18.4 points a game. He was 8th nationally from 3-point range last season.
Wow.
BJ Simmons, who's a JUCO guard out of Texas, who has a little less impressive list. He feels like a little bit of a backup option for them at this point. But URI certainly targeting backcourt scoring, boost on offense. Those are 2 sore spots under David Cox for 3 years. They've been outside the national 125 in efficiency. And their three-point shooting, they've been, you know, in the bottom 100 all three seasons. You know, so certainly an area that, they could use a boost. And if they could get someone to play aside Shepherd, Leggett, Martin, stands to reason you'd have the big guys up front with, Mekhi Mitchell coming back and Antoine Walker still there.
Yeah, which would be nice. Yeah, so yeah, it's not surprising that they would want to you know, find some more, you know, guard help and yeah, scoring off the bench. It's things that we talked about before. But having Jeremy back is, I think, a real plus for them, because I think it allows them to sort of build out from there, you know, in terms of the depth in your rotation.
No question. You know, and I think that's really important going into what is going to be a critical year for URI to get this thing back on track.
Yep.
You know, Brown also has grad transfer out, a Barrington native, Matt DeWolf, a guy who we've watched since high school, help lead the Eagles to the Ryan Center with his old buddy Corey Dougherty, who eventually joined him at Brown as well. Matt DeWolf will take a fifth year at Washington State. He will play in the Pac-12. Washington State is coached by Kyle Smith. He was formerly at Columbia for six seasons, went 25-10 in his last year, moved on to San Francisco, and now he has finished up his second year with the Cougars. So he knows the Ivy League well. I would imagine he probably got a good evaluation on Matt DeWolf from Mike Martin personally. You know, Matt is the type of kid who is going to graduate from Brown. He's a paint guy, you know, hard worker inside. Could be an extra live body at a Power 5 school. You would imagine that they've said to him, look, you're going to come off the bench. You might play 12, 15 minutes a game, you know, but you're going to play at the highest level of college basketball. You know, and that's obviously something that appealed to him and seems like a good fit. You know, and it's just a reminder that there just aren't many people walking around in the world who can walk and chew gum at 6'9". You know, and those guys are always going to be desirable out there on the transfer market.
Yeah, and I think this is a great thing for Matt. Being able to play in the Pac-12, that's a great opportunity for him. Getting his degree from Brown and then being able to do this. You know, he's a good kid with a supportive family. I always think of, you know, some of the families I'd see at the Brown games afterwards, and I always saw the DeWolfs in supporting Matt. Whether Matt played 2 minutes or 20 minutes, they were always there.
Right.
So it's a great opportunity for him. And I think, you know, Matt probably looked at it, and I'm sure that with the Ivy League presidents coming out and saying, look, you can, you know, you can play a grad transfer year this 1 year next year because of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that he maybe looked at, you know, possibly, you know, okay, where would I fit at Brown? And I think, you know, the previous season, because obviously they didn't play this year.
Yep.
I think some of the minutes that Matt was getting, and especially that starting role too, started going toward Jalen Gainey.
Correct.
And I think rightfully so. Jalen was, he was a monster for them, and obviously was coming into his own. So, you know, Matt's minutes were sort of cut down. He was part of the bench, you know, and trying to, you know, contribute that way. So this is a great opportunity for him. I think it was one of those, again, I'm sure that Mike and Matt both talked and said,
mm-hmm.
Look, we'd love to have you, but, you know, this opportunity is here, you know. I'm sure Mike said, go take it. You know, of course we'd love to have you, but take it. Go to Washington State. Go play in the Pac-12. You're getting your degree. So, you know, go out there and be well. And Brown is going to be, they're okay with some, you know, their depth that they have with a guy like Gainey coming back.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's not something that's been talked about. It's been very quiet. You know, I'm not sure. I don't have much insight right now, but with this extra year for Ivy League players, I can't help but think that Mike and his staff have been talking to Tamanang Cho.
Yes.
I know he's getting a lot of calls and offers from big programs, but look, if they could bring him back, you know, Brown is going to be in really, really good shape.
Yeah, Jalen Gainey was the Ivy League Defensive Player of the Year in 2019-20. He was 11th nationally in block percentage that year. You would certainly look at him and Matt DeWolf and say there is more upside there with Jalen Gainey.
Sure.
You pretty much know who Matt DeWolf is. He's a good player in the Ivy League.
Mm-hmm.
Jalen Gainey can be a special player in the Ivy League.
Yeah.
And so if Brown is going to play the way we think they're going to play with one big and four sort of smalls, you know, guards and interchangeable wings and forwards and whatever it may be, that would sort of relegate Matt to a backup role as a center. You know, if he doesn't want to do that for a fifth year, I fully understand that. And if you want to go get a sense of what the other side of college basketball is like, off the bus and on charters and, you know, playing at UCLA and whatever else, I don't begrudge him that.
Good for him.
Not for 1 second.
Yeah.
You know, and in fact, Mike Martin congratulated Matt DeWolf on Twitter on Thursday night, you know, said that, that Brown would be rooting for him while he's at Washington State. That's no surprise. You know, so we wish him the best. It's always nice to see a Rhode Island guy make good.
It's great. To, you know, the Pac-12, too, like, that's...
Absolutely.
It's big time. It's great.
You know, and to add on to that, he's getting his degree from Brown University, which is most important.
Yeah.
You know, this next year in Washington, you know, who knows? There could be a pro opportunity that comes out of that. We have no idea. But in terms of the rest of his life, he has done what he set out to do at Brown. So critically important.
Oh, it's awesome. It's awesome.
It is.
Yeah.
One other noteworthy transfer with Rhode Island ties, that's Tyler Kolick. George Mason guard, Cumberland native, has put his name into the transfer portal. George Mason fired head coach Dave Paulson. They've since hired Kim English, who was a really good guard at Missouri. I remember him well. He's a Baltimore native, and so you're thinking that he's going to be able to recruit maybe that D.C., DMV area a little better and maybe get George Mason on a more sustainable track going forward. I know they finished sixth in the A-10 this year, but over the six-year tenure of Dave Paulson, maybe not necessarily the return that they were hoping for. So Tyler Kolick is into the portal. Averaged almost 11 points per game. He led George Mason in three-point makes. And his college list is going to look a lot different this time than it did the last time he was being recruited out of St. George's. Jeff Borzello from ESPN, who does a great job on the college hoop scene for them, said that Kolick has heard from Providence, Boston College, and UConn regionally. Those are three schools that did not offer him the first time around. He's also heard from Vanderbilt, TCU, Notre Dame, Stanford, Davidson, Richmond, Wofford, Loyola, Chicago, Butler. That is certainly a better list than the first group of schools that he got to pick from after his prep year at St. George's. And that's no disrespect to the places that recruited him in any way, shape, or form. Brown and Bryant were schools who offered him. You know, Elon and Northeastern were schools that offered him. They're good mid-major programs. He opted to choose a school in the A-10 because he wanted to challenge himself a little bit at the highest level he could. And now at this point, it seems like he's going to have a chance to do even better than that, whether it be in the Power Five or in the Big East. So I'm really interested to see how the transfer market spins for him.
Yeah, I wonder where he fits. This is a great list for Tyler, a kid who's a hard worker, a kid who really just. Listening to Tim talk about getting in the gym and listening to, you know, C.J. Ward, his trainer and assistant coach.
Plymouth Mass, folks. Plymouth Mass.
The two of them. They love talking about being in the gym. So it strikes me the work ethic that that they have in getting him, you know, to where he wants to go. And to be the A-10 Rookie of the Year, you know, again, kudos to him. And that's why he has the list that he has. And so, you know, my next thought is, you know, where does he fit?
Right.
Could he fit? What would he do at a Providence?
Right.
You know, what would his role be? You know, if he goes to Providence, you know, I don't think Tyler's not a starter for Providence, not immediately.
Nope.
But is he a guy, as we've seen, is he a guy that comes in off the bench and gives them, you know, good shooting and scoring? I would think so. You know, is it a UConn or a Boston College? I think Boston College is going to try to bring in as much talent as they can, obviously with a new coach and trying to, you know, sort of steer that program in the right direction. So
right.
Could he get more opportunity to Boston College because they need, you know, good talent like that? I don't know. I think of fit and role and where he could be, but it's exciting to see this list and sort of envision him, okay, where could Tyler fit in all of these different places?
I see a lot of good offenses on that list. I see a lot of offenses that space, that shoot the three, that would fit his game style. You know, the question would be, as you mentioned, you go to Boston College, you get to play in the ACC. You don't necessarily get to finish in the top half of the ACC. It's not necessarily a guarantee. There are some other schools on that list that you might play a little less, but you might have a little more team success. You might have a chance to play in the NCAA tournament a couple times. You might have the chance to work your way into a position where you start by your third or your fourth year, and you're a leader, and you might set yourself up where you could be a pro eventually, because you've been exposed to better competition, not only in games, but in practices every day. You're playing against guys who were higher-rated recruits, who have more upside than you do. I don't think that can be overstated in terms of if you want to be a professional player into your 20s and early 30s. You need to build that foundation now. So if he was to go to someplace like UConn, let's say, and someone like Rashul Diggins comes in, you know, Rashul Diggins is going to play ahead of him. He's a top 100 recruit, somebody who Dan Hurley valued very highly. Somebody like Corey Floyd is a more highly rated recruit and someone who's probably going to be given a chance to play more when he comes in for 22-23. But that doesn't mean that Kolick isn't going to get better, that he wouldn't play for them at all.
Yeah.
That he wouldn't have a chance to play on a national stage. And I think that there are a lot of programs on that list who can afford him that opportunity. And of course, that's why you put your name in the portal. You want to see what's out there. You want to see how different it is from the first time that you went through it. And I would say that you and I sort of live on social media. We need to do it. It's one of the things that we have to do for our jobs. It's not always the greatest place to be. Twitter can be a cesspool. We've talked about it, I don't know how many times. I say that to journalism classes all the time. The transfer portal, I think a lot of fans look at it and say, we're never going to be able to keep our players. We're going to have to re-recruit our whole roster every year. This is basically glorified free agency in college basketball. There's no commitments anymore. None of it means anything. I think for someone like Tyler Kolick, in his individual case, when you have outperformed the school that you initially committed to, I think you've earned the right to put your name out there and potentially have a different college basketball experience. It's your life. It's your career. It gives you a certain measure of autonomy over it.
I forgive me for being distracted here, but
that's okay.
There's some big my phone was just going off because there's some big news in the NFL that could potentially have a domino effect with the New England Patriots. Adam Schefter just said that the Dolphins and the 49ers have made a trade, and the Niners now have the number 3 overall pick in the 2021 NFL draft.
So they're picking a quarterback.
So they're probably going to take a quarterback, which is why I just got a text from Ian Steele that had two words, and it said, "Hi, Jimmy."
Certain handsome-looking Greek lad, Jimmy Garoppolo, chin of granite.
And I literally, there's three people texting me. I'm like, something's going on.
Yeah.
And one of them was a picture of a smiling Jimmy Garoppolo. So that's why, forgive me for being distracted, Bill. I wanted to lock in on the podcast. Phone started to started to blow up here.
I'm certainly capable of ranting on and on and on.
No, you were fine.
And carrying the pod.
You were giving an insightful diatribe there. That was very good.
My first of the day.
And a boy. All right, so I'm going to lock back in, but interesting news there. We could have a quarterback here in New England soon.
Sure.
Okay. You were saying about Tyler?
Just in terms of the fact that this could be the good side of the transfer portal. If we're really going to talk about player empowerment and players having the same rights, the same freedom as coaches to move from school to school after you outperform your previous place, Tyler Kolick could be on the good side of that.
Absolutely. No, this is what the transfer market and portal is, I think, supposed to be like. For a guy like a Tyler Kolick who goes to a program, commits to a program, plays really well, has a great season, and then if there's a change in the program, it gives him the option to, evaluate what he wants to do next while also looking on the outside and saying, where can I go? Because I've had success in this conference, in this program, and maybe I can do it on a bigger stage with a bigger program,
right,
somewhere different. So I think it's all about finding the right place where he can highlight his strengths, be a great contributor. Obviously, with all the eligibility he has left, he's got a lot of time. So wherever he goes, he can contribute for a few years down the line here.
Yeah, no doubt that he's going to be a popular guy. You know, he's going to be getting a lot of calls over the next few weeks. You would imagine that wherever he lands is going to be a pretty nice next home for him. We'll get into some other high-profile transfers, some other discussions elsewhere as we go through the NCAA tournament. There are some situations developing, whether it be player-wise, coaching-wise, that we will branch off from our general discussion about the first 4 days of March Madness. Coit, I will just say this, Coit. I am so grateful that these games are back.
Oh, it's awesome.
I am so thankful that we got to watch the NCAA tournament again for 4 days. I went to a friend's house on Friday. My friends Mike and Allie. Mike I graduated from high school with. Allie is a huge URI fan. They are kind enough to host folks on the first day of the NCAA tournament every year. In this particular year, everyone who was in attendance was either vaccinated or had rapid COVID tests. We did it safely. You know, and it was a great day of basketball. Those 12 or 13 hours or so were just a reminder of what we missed. Nine double-digit seeds winning in the first round. 15s, 14s, 13s, 12s, 11s, 10s, all the way through. Buzzer beaters, upsets. It was just, I was in heaven for 4 days. I really was. It was so refreshing to actually feel like you were going back to what it was before all this.
Yeah.
It just felt so good.
It was great. And the competition level was fantastic. Even the first four, I thought, were good games. It was really enjoyable.
Yes.
Yeah, it was great for me to just be able to go. I was just kind of going through my daily routine. You know, I'd go down. I'd go sit on an exercise bike for a half hour, turn the TV on. You know, I was watching the Arkansas-Colgate game, and I was sweating even more seeing the first half.
Yeah, me too.
Because sorry to our friend Keegan Records, but I have Arkansas in my Final Four. And so,
and
you know.
Colgate's up 14.
Yeah, right. So you just you enjoy that. You love it. I was out with some friends on Saturday, and you know, one of them had UConn, and obviously, you know, Maryland beat them. So, you know, I'm looking at his bracket, and he's got it on the table. I take a pen, I start crossing it out.
Yeah.
But of course, that's what happens with this is karma. And by the end of the night, he's pointing and laughing at me when Abilene Christian knocks out Texas, who was in my Final Four.
Right.
So this is the beauty of it. But the games were just fantastic. I thought the round of 64 games, I think, were probably a little bit, I don't know, a little bit more exciting. Though that first night, that first day of round of 32 games was really, really entertaining. That was Sunday, I believe. Just a lot of good matchups, a lot of close games. I think the second day, I think the cream sort of rose to the top on that Monday.
Yes.
A lot of those games were sort of wide margins.
Yes.
But even then, who cares? It was great to watch. It was really fun. And now we've got a Sweet 16 that is just amazingly interesting to me. I mean, I look at the Midwest, and you're talking about a 2 versus an 11 and an 8 versus 12.
Yes. Yes.
What?
Yeah.
What is that?
That's right.
It's crazy. And some of our predictions, Bill, I think came true. Some of them, obviously, did not.
We're going to go over a few of those.
Okay.
As we continue here on the podcast. As we warned everyone, because all three of us, Coit and I and Maury Hirsch-Gordon from WPRI 12 and Fox Providence, as we did our three-man weave, our preview for the NCAA tournament, we all picked Gonzaga, Illinois in the final. We did that independently. We did not do it together. We brought our brackets in and taped the podcast. And as soon as we discovered that we had all picked Gonzaga, Illinois in the final, we told you that it would not happen.
Mm-hmm.
That there's no way it would happen, because those sort of things, when everyone wants to go one way, it tends to go the other way. And sure enough, Illinois gets picked off by Sister Jean in Loyola Chicago. I'm 6-for-16 in my Sweet 16. I have three Final Four teams still alive: Gonzaga, Arkansas, and Florida State. I feel less good about my picks than I did at this time a week ago. But that is the wonderfulness that is the NCAA tournament. I told myself going in that I would be less upset than I would be in a typical year if one of my teams got picked off. When Colgate was up 14 on Arkansas in the first half, I found my blood pressure rising a little bit. So I could only lie to myself for so long.
Now, imagine doing that and literally sitting on an exercise bike while that's happening.
Right.
I'm churning and I'm sweating and I'm like, what is going on? You know, holy cow.
Yeah, I tried to con myself and it didn't quite work because I am, at the end of the day, I am a prideful person. I'd like to think that some of my picks were correct and a lot of them were not. But I think that's just the nature of this tournament, especially this year. I think we've seen some wild things. We still have one local link to the bracket left. That's Cole Swider and Villanova. They will play Baylor on Saturday, 5:15 on CBS. Villanova, a bit of a surprise into the Sweet 16. Without Colin Gillespie, who has not played, Villanova took care of Winthrop in their first game, avoiding the 5-12 upset. You and Maury were both on Villanova. You were sort of smart in that way that you were going against the public. I think a lot of the public looked, a lot of the gamblers out there looked and said, well, Winthrop's going to win. I mean, here's the 5-12. Villanova doesn't have their best guy. When everyone likes the dog, go to the fave. And Villanova handled North Texas in that second game. The Mean Green, who you picked over Purdue.
Mean Green.
Pat on the back for that.
Mean Green.
So Villanova is into the Sweet 16. Even this diminished version of Villanova that lost at Providence, that lost Georgetown in the Big East tournament. Round of applause to Cole Swider and to Jay Wright and the crew.
Well, because they really reworked things, too, before they got to the tournament. They said, okay, we're not going to have Colin, so let's adjust on who's running the offense, who's handling the ball, and that's the thing with Villanova. Everybody's bought into it, and Jay is too good of a coach to, you know, just sort of run it out there without much of a plan, and they had a plan. They adjusted things on the fly, and, you know, when you have that kind of talent that you're bringing in every year, I think you're able to do that and find different strengths and find different ways to win. And so that's what they did. So credit to them.
Yeah, two Big East teams in the Sweet 16. Creighton is the other. Creighton survives against UC Santa Barbara in the first game. They handle Ohio in the second game. Round of applause to you and Maury, who both had Creighton in the Sweet 16.
Did I?
You did.
You sure?
Did. I listened back to the podcast. You did. Oh. I don't know if you wrote it down in your brackets.
Yeah, maybe not.
But you had them there verbally.
Okay.
You did.
Okay, great.
you also got a little other benefit in that West region, Coity. Bill Self went down hard against USC.
If I told you one thing on the podcast, I told you, do not trust Rock Chalk Jayhawk. Not happening.
No.
Nope.
You were
told you,
and I advised you not to gamble with your feelings, but in that matchup, as I said, I have USC going to the Elite Eight, and so I enjoyed very much the fact that USC won that game by 34, just totally thrashed Kansas. Crushed them with that 2-3 zone, and then in the second half started making threes like crazy. It was really impressive. I don't know if there have been many teams who have looked better than USC through two games. I mean, they look like world beaters against the Jayhawks.
Andy Enfield, he's got the experience, man.
He does,
and it's nice to see somebody like that was with a smaller program that had success, go to a bigger conference and a bigger program, and continue to have that sort of success with the formula that he has.
You know, they play elite defense. They're just so long in that zone. You know, you got the Mobley brothers out there. Evans, a 7-footer, but athletic. They shrink the floor in that way. There's just not much space to work with. You could see Kansas was completely confused, and by the end of first half, they were completely out of ideas. Just did not know what to do against USC. Both of you guys, you and Maury, nailed the West region All four teams in the Sweet 16, Gonzaga, Creighton, USC, and Oregon. You were both on to the upset, Oregon running past Iowa. Unfortunately, Oregon's first round game was canceled. VCU had a COVID positive, multiple COVID positives, and they were disqualified from the tournament. But Oregon, Dana Altman, getting it done yet again. They're in the Sweet 16 again. There's a 6-7 game, an all Pac-12 game, four Pac-12 teams to the Sweet 16. The only one who misses out is Colorado. Coity, just looking at the conferences, the Pac-12 is the huge winner here with four out of the Sweet 16, and all four of the teams have looked good doing it.
I think the Pac-12 is the winner, and the Big Ten is clearly taking a huge hit here.
The big loser.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
It makes sense. Yeah, I did have a 6-7 matchup. Wow. Okay. All right. Well, I did one thing right. That's good. I'm glad.
No, we're taking notes.
I got my bracket in front of me, and I had Creighton. I'm a little surprised. Huh. All right. Hey, whatever. That's good.
We need to give credit because the demerits are going to be coming up soon on the podcast. But you guys both nailed the Sweet 16 in the West. And honestly, I mean, Creighton had a scare in that first game with UC Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. But other than that, none of those results were in doubt, really.
No.
USC looked impressive. Oregon in their only game against Oregon was against Iowa was impressive. And Gonzaga, obviously, they got pushed a little bit by Oklahoma. But you watch Gonzaga, Oklahoma, and you think to yourself, well, Gonzaga's not really playing that well. And they're up 15.
They're unbelievable.
They're horrifying.
It's unbelievable
how good
they
are.
Yeah, that was sort of my first chance to get a glimpse of Gonzaga. Because all I've seen is sort of highlights and snippets here and there. And whew, holy cow, Timmy is... he's a player, and he's got players around him. I mean, Mark Few, just what a squad, man. What a squad. This is a real opportunity for them to bring home a national title. It really is.
Now, they've been fantastic. And it's a credit to them that even when it looks like they're only in second or third gear, they're still pulling away.
Yeah.
There's just the overall skill level there in that lineup is just amazing.
Yeah.
And the way that they're able to find each other. Is wonderful. They play really good basketball. If you're just looking at fundamental offensive game, spacing, passing, shooting, athleticism, they just have it all. Very difficult team to beat. I still feel very good about picking them as my national champion.
Me too.
Really feel like they're going to get it done. But as we've seen in the past, you get to the Sweet 16, you have that week off, a team prepares for you. Who knows? Creighton's going to want to get up and down with them. They run into Creighton on a night where Creighton makes 14, 15 threes. The calculus in that game could change.
If Ballock is 6-for-7 from beyond the arc,
exactly,
You're in big trouble.
Yep, and Jefferson and Mahoney are the type of interchangeable defenders who could make life difficult for Gonzaga in that offense. We'll see. Morey was on to a concept. He didn't have the right team, but he was on to a concept about a team in the first four advancing to the Sweet 16. He liked Michigan State. It was, in fact, UCLA.
Yeah.
Michigan State had them beat, to be fair. Lost the game in the last 3 minutes and then in overtime. And all UCLA has done is win three games in a row and has had one of the best players in the tournament to this point in Johnny Juzang, who has looked really, really,
really
good.
Really good, yeah.
Took care of BYU, who I had in my Sweet 16, and then took care of Abilene Christian. The upset darlings there went down in the second round by 20. Just couldn't score enough. But UCLA with Hep Cronin, Mick Cronin's dad, sitting in the stands.
Excellent.
It's great to see Hep Cronin watching his boy coach UCLA, the Bruins, in their second year under Cronin. As I said on the podcast last week, back where they should be,
yeah,
in the Sweet 16. That's one of the elite programs in college basketball. They should never be down for too long.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to see. Look, Abilene Christian, though, if you're going to win and knock out my Final Four team, keep winning, please. Don't bow out in the round of 32. Oh, man. It was an exciting game to see. That was. And, I fell for Shaka. I fell for Shaka magic there.
We'll get a little more to Shaka later in the pod.
Yeah.
Coit, you did have North Texas over Purdue. That was a nice upset pick by you.
Thank you.
I had that one wrong. I had Purdue in my Elite Eight. oops. Coit had Oregon State. I don't know if that was a nod to our friend Kate Rogerson, who is out there covering the Beavers now. But Oregon State into the Sweet 16 under Wayne Tinkle. You know, playing very well at this point. Oregon State taking out Tennessee, who was a little bit diminished in that first game. The second win that Oregon State had was over Oklahoma State, who I thought would lose in the first round to Liberty. They managed to beat the Flames. But then in that second game, some of those ills that I thought Oklahoma State could have sort of popped up down the stretch. Oregon State wins the game 80-70. Oklahoma State's making a big run at the end. They're down three. It's a 70-67 game. Cade Cunningham makes a three. Here's your number one pick in the draft. Makes a three. He's leading the way. Here's your guy. There's 3 minutes to go. He takes one of the next six shots. Basketball in the postseason, basketball at that level, in crunch time, is not a democracy. It is not. Cade Cunningham is your version of LeBron James. He needs to touch it every possession. He needs to shoot it whenever the heck he wants. And he needs to distribute it if he sees fit. The fact that he only took one of the next six shots is why Oklahoma State lost that game.
I saw you tweeting about this, and I couldn't agree more. I was watching the end of that, and I'm like, where is Cade Cunningham? That's a problem if we're asking that question when we're watching that game. So I saw you tweeting about it. I'm totally with you on that. That's why Oregon State's there.
That's in the Midwest region. You know, we go to the bottom half of that region, and good times for Maury Hirsch Gordon with Syracuse. Getting through America's nightmare, Nick Coit's personal nightmare.
A lot of ibuprofen after that.
Having to share a studio on Saturday mornings with Scott Cordishi.
Him singing the fight song and all that.
A proud Syracuse grad. The Cuse, a double-digit seed. They are through to a Sweet 16 for the third time as a double-digit seed since 2016. They've gone to the Final Four, the Sweet 16, and now the Sweet 16 again. Syracuse taking out San Diego State, who I had in my Elite Eight, wrong. And then taking out West Virginia, hanging on against West Virginia. The Mountaineers were poor in the first half of that game. They got it going, but too late. You know, missed a bunch of threes early. And Buddy Boeheim has turned into a guy who all of a sudden looks like an NBA player.
Yeah.
The coach's kid, you know, who's sort of a... sort of trying to find his way through the first couple of years. You look and you say, oh, this is a nepotism recruit. You know, can he really play here? You know, he had games where you looked and thought, well, he's kind of out of place. Last five or six games now, the way he's shooting the ball, the confidence he has, certainly looks like a worthy player of Syracuse, of the ACC, and of the Sweet 16.
Confidence. That's what it's about for a shooter like that. And, yeah, he's beaming with confidence right now. He's oozing it. And so... yeah, not surprised. Syracuse plays its best basketball at this time of the year. What more could you want out of a program? Honestly, no matter what happens during a regular season, no matter what happens, how rocky it is, how a month ago my co-host on WEEI wanted to move on from the Hall of Fame coach, which, you know, hey, look, performance is what it is. And, you know, obviously a lot of alums weren't happy with the program, but they got things going in the right direction. They were peaking at the right time, and here they are sitting in the Sweet 16. Thinking back to last season, I feel awful for San Diego State because I don't think they truly got their chance to make their run that they wanted to make. They were missing some of the guys that they had last year,
right,
that obviously didn't get the opportunity to be part of a team that would have been, correct me if I'm wrong, a number one seed in the tournament last year.
Yeah, they and Dayton both. I think both would have gotten number one seeds.
That's what I couldn't help but think that when, you know, they were sort of bowing out and they were bringing some of the guys off the floor that night. I'm like, man, your heart breaks for them because, you know, for a program like that, this stage can be such a... it's not only such a memorable time and memorable moment, but really a program propeller. You know, because if they had made a run to, say, the Final Four last year, you know, who's to say that San Diego State can't go out and get any, you know, any guy that they want around their area and say, well, we're a Final Four team. We're building our program. This is the direction we're going, you know. So it's unfortunate that that happened with San Diego State.
Yeah, they've had some success. Obviously, they've been a two seed under Steve Fisher previously. This is now Brian Dutcher coaching, who was Steve Fisher's assistant at San Diego State and previously at Michigan. He helped Steve Fisher recruit the Fab Five. So there are long-standing ties there. Brian Dutcher has done a good job establishing himself as a good coach with the Aztecs. I agree with you, though. When you look at these programs who are outside the Power Five in the Big East, when lightning strikes like that, you just need to be able to bottle it. And it was just such a shame for San Diego State and for Dayton to not be able to finish last season. And you're reminded of that when they lose the first game in something like this, when Dayton misses the tournament like they did this year and Obi Toppin goes in the draft. You're just reminded of how fleeting those moments might be outside of the power structure in the game.
We bring up the conversation about, you know, Ed Cooley and his time at Providence all the time, but what would his resume look like if last year that team continues to play the way it was playing
and make
March?
A Sweet 16, right?
What would the conversation be right
what's,
now?
What's the perception of Ed? How much does it change if he has a Sweet 16 on his resume? Does he get the Michigan job if he has a Sweet 16 on his resume?
Yeah.
If he goes to the Final Four?
Yeah.
Do they opt not to go to Juwan Howard?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Crazy.
But just so many things got thrown up in the air. And part of that is what makes this tournament great, is the upsets. It's the things that you can't see, would never see. I had a couple. I had Ohio over Virginia. I felt like a lot of that had to do with COVID.
Yeah.
Because Virginia just hadn't played, hadn't quarantined. Abilene Christian over Texas, I feel great about. That's one of those that you look at and you go out on a limb and you pick it and you have solid reasoning for it. And when the favorite wins by 20, you know, everyone comes on Twitter and they're in your emails and they're saying, idiot, you know, dude, how could you see it? You know, you idiot, you moron, you know. And yes, it's a 100-1 shot. Abilene Christian isn't supposed to beat Texas. No way.
Yeah.
But when Joe Pleasant's making those two ice cold free throws to win the game, and you see what it means to those guys, the fact that they just beat Texas.
Mm-hmm.
None of the guys on their roster would be recruited by Texas. Just such a special night for a program like that, who might never achieve something like that again. You just realize how much more it means to them than, say, you know, somebody like UCLA or Michigan or Gonzaga or Duke, who are just in the Sweet 16 every single year.
Well, and I think there's no better example right now going into a Sweet 16 than people have to look up and figure out where Oral Roberts is.
Yeah.
Where is Oral Roberts University? What is Oral Roberts University? What kind of programs do they have academically? Like all these things.
Maybe don't look into who Oral Roberts is.
Okay.
And maybe don't look into who their university is.
Okay.
Because you're going to scrape into some religious things there that you might not want to find.
Okay. Won't do that.
But as an athletic program,
thank you for the advice.
I can tell you that they're in Tulsa.
Sure.
I know that because our buddy Jeff Cole is in Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
He knows Oral Roberts well. He was tweeting about the gravity of the fact that Oral Roberts just beat Ohio State and Florida in basketball.
Yeah.
Oral Roberts has had a very good baseball program for a long time.
That's where I had heard it before.
They produced an outfielder named Bob Zupczyk, who was a Red Sox prospect and played in the big leagues for a while. But generally, they are not a basketball school. The Oral Roberts women are quite good. They've been four of the last eight NCAA tournaments. But for the men to break through in this way, to beat Ohio State 15-2, and then to handle Florida in the second game, they are the second 15 seed to reach a Sweet 16. The only other was Florida Gulf Coast, Dunk City, with Andy Enfield, who we mentioned earlier.
Right.
So just wonderful to see the 15 still dancing, going into the second weekend of the tournament. They have a very tall task, as you would imagine, playing Arkansas. That was an Arkansas team who they actually played already this season.
Oh.
Let me look this up just to be sure. Yes, they played Arkansas earlier this year, lost by 11 on the road. They led that game by 10 points at halftime.
Ooh.
Arkansas showed up in the second half and restored order, but very similar to what happened when Arkansas played Colgate.
Yeah.
They got rushed a little bit early. The talent, the pace, the pedigree of their players ultimately won out over 40 minutes. But you have to assume that Oral Roberts isn't going to go on that floor and think, oh, no, we're playing Arkansas. You've already beaten two Power 5 teams.
Yeah, absolutely. And you got nothing to lose at this point. You're a 15 seed in the Sweet 16. You know, of course, you got nothing to lose. But Arkansas is tough in that way. You mentioned it. Like, their athleticism, when they just flipped that switch in that game against Colgate, oof, boy, defensively, offensively, it started to look really good for them. So they're tough. The team that maybe quietly I might have been maybe the most impressed with, you know, through the first two rounds, that quietly is in the Sweet 16, and I say that, it's funny that I say that because they're a number one seed. Baylor is dangerous,
yep.
Bill. Baylor's dangerous. Nobody is talking about Baylor because they went on a COVID pause and they sort of fizzled after that during the season. But they've come into this tournament and they've quietly taken care of business, and here they are in the Sweet 16. And that's, to me, Baylor may be the biggest threat to Gonzaga trying to make its run to an undefeated season.
Stupid me. I had Wisconsin beating North Carolina, correct, but then beating Baylor, wrong. Baylor ends up winning that game 76-63 and did it rather easily. Yeah, Baylor has looked good. You know, no doubt they and Gonzaga for a long time this season were the two clear consensus best teams. Baylor lost a couple games late. As you mentioned, they were on pause, had COVID issues. You wondered how that would affect them. Not a great defensive team. You wondered how that would affect them. They were able to grind it out against Wisconsin, which was impressive. You mentioned one seeds being impressive and sort of sneaking their way into the Sweet 16. Michigan has done the same.
Yeah.
Michigan, you know, beating LSU in the round of 32, you know, able to outscore LSU. Playing without Isaiah Livers, who is a really important guy for them, matching up with Florida State in the Sweet 16, you know, just another example of the job that Juwan Howard has done at his alma mater. I'm so impressed. I watched a fair amount of that game, Michigan and LSU. I'm so impressed with the way Michigan executes on offense. They run some really nice stuff, whether it's... And you could see that Juwan Howard was on an NBA bench for a long time.
Yeah.
When you look at the schemes they run, especially at the offensive end, it's a lot of pick and roll. He's got nice action on the wings in terms of spacing, in terms of screening. He's got skilled guys who can shoot it. He's got guys who recognize driving lanes and can get to the rim. You know, just some really nice stuff, really nice execution in the second half in a game that was on the table. LSU, serious talent. Cam Thomas is a really good player and is going to be an NBA guy, one of several who will be pros on that roster. You know, but I was really impressed with Michigan, the way they've played, much in similar fashion to Villanova. You know, missing a star player and still getting to the Sweet 16. That's culture. That's coaching. That's a bunch of guys who really buy in.
And they have smart players. You mentioned it. Like, they have smart guys. Mike Smith, to me, I mean, yeah, he was from an Ivy League school, so yeah, he's got to be wicked smart, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but no, Mike Smith was a good player at Columbia. He was a good player.
Yes.
So you bring him into a program like this, and I'm sure that those were the types of guys that they're looking at. And so when they're able to pick these things up and run the schemes, as you mentioned, that they're able to run, It shows that they've got some experience. And so, yeah, good for Michigan for finding the right guys. And you're right. When Juwan Howard has the type of experience that he has had already outside of his playing career, you know, it's valuable. It's valuable. And, you know, credit them again for just finding the right mix of guys that work for what they want to do.
Now, really good, really impressive. That should be a great game against Florida State, who
Leonard
I have
Hamilton.
In the Final Four.
Yeah, he's good.
But Leonard Hamilton, I think that's really the last thing missing from his resume is to get to a Final Four. Florida State, like USC, seems to shrink the floor. They're the tallest team in the nation. You know, and when you watch them on defense, there's just no space to do anything against those guys. He always seems to have a couple seven-footers on his roster, and he always seems to have just these athletic 6'7", 6'8"-ish type wing players who look overgrown for their positions that they're playing. But they're just so impressive. What they did to Colorado in the second round, Colorado's a good team.
Yeah.
Florida State made them look average. 71-53 in that game. They just smothered them defensively. If they play that sort of defense, Michigan is going to have a hard time executing a lot of the things that they did against LSU, who is nowhere near the defensive team that Florida State is.
Some of these ACC programs sometimes, Bill, I'll never forget watching and seeing the size when Rhode Island a couple of years ago played Duke in that second round of the NCAA tournament.
Sure.
And they had Bagley, and they had those just massive guys.
Wendell Carter was on that team.
I'll never forget sitting behind that basket where Rhode Island was shooting at and seeing them play in a zone. And the wingspan of those guys, Bill, it was like they could literally lock hands or lock arms, and there was nowhere to go on the floor.
Right.
They were so large. So some of these ACC schools, it's staggering the type of defense you can play with that kind of size when everybody's bought in like that. And clearly Leonard Hamilton has that buy-in from his guys. And when you play that kind of defense, that's what's required is guys to, you know, really embrace what you're doing. And you're right, Colorado is a good team. I think I had them, that was one of my misses, is I think I had them being upset in the first round. But they're a good team, you know. And who did Colorado? Oh, yeah, because I had Georgetown. I fell for the Georgetown trick there.
Yeah.
Yeah, they beat them up. But you're right. So they outclassed them in that game, and then they go against Florida State, and they get beat by 18. Like, it's wow. So it's a credit to Florida State. That really is going to be a good game, the Seminoles and the Wolverines.
Yeah, Duke in that game in 2018, Duke actually switched to that zone down the stretch.
Oh.
Krzyzewski is usually a man-to-man coach, but it wasn't necessarily working at Duke. And the size just made them so difficult to play against. You're bringing Javon Delorier and Marcus Bolden off the bench. That's 6'10 and 6'11 in that game against URI. You add those to Bagley and to Wendell Carter, who ended up being lottery picks. It's very difficult to recruit that. It's very difficult to match up against it. You know, Florida State playing Michigan, another Power 5 team, you take it for granted that they're going to have representative physical pieces.
Yeah.
But Florida State just seems to have more of them for whatever reason in a given year. You know, Leonard Hamilton is able to assemble a roster that is just physically imposing in that way.
It's crazy.
The bottom half of the East region, we did get some of the carnage that you were calling for. Unfortunately, it didn't break my way. I had UConn in the Elite Eight.
Yeah.
Wrong. UConn got smothered by Maryland in that first game, really looked bad on offense. It was a complete stinker. And then Maryland goes out in the next game and gets run over by Alabama, who is into the Sweet 16. They will play UCLA. That's a really entertaining matchup in the other half of that bracket. You know, Coyte, I watched a fair amount of Alabama and Maryland, and I tweeted this at the time. Alabama looks like Rick Pitino's teams looked at Kentucky in the 90s. To me, they're just the type of team that all of a sudden they snow on you with three-pointers. They go on this run once a game where you just can't deal with them. Defensively, they speed you up. They force you to turn it over. They take you out of everything that you want to do. The second half, Maryland just couldn't deal with them at all. You know, Alabama turned it into a pickup game, essentially. It looked that easy. It was like they strolled in to play intramurals, you know, with a bunch of guys who were just there to run up and down, and they completely overmatched a Maryland team that's in the Big Ten, that has elite recruits. It was so impressive to see that kind of surge and the way they were doing it with the three-point shooting and the active defense and the forcing of turnovers. It looked a lot like those Antoine Walker, Tony Delk, Walter McCarty teams that Rick Pitino had in the 90s.
Yeah, and when you can play that style and it works, it's how do you stop it? You know, how do you slow it down? If they're making shots and the confidence is high like that, and especially with a coach like Nate Oates, who, you know, he's an energizer himself on the bench. And so, you know, they'll just keep it going and make it rain on you. So to see that from Alabama. We saw Alabama earlier this season, too. They're just...
Playing the Friars.
Yeah,
that's right.
When they play well, it's tough to slow them down.
Yeah. No, they once they get that tempo going, they make a few shots, it's really, really difficult to live with them.
Yeah.
They have elite guards. They have athleticism up front. It's just, you know, Nate Oates, we talk about coaches and teams taking the identity of their coaches.
Yeah.
Nate Oates got some swagger, man.
Absolutely.
Nate Oates has got a little something.
Mm-hmm.
He took a little jab at Coach K earlier this year. You remember that?
That he did.
Nate Oates got a little something.
Yeah.
He does.
And his players feed off of it.
And he's a high school coach 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Think about that.
But think about the guys that he had in high school.
Oh, absolutely. He's running a power program at Romulus. He's got a certain guy named E.C. Matthews, who everyone knows here and loves. But just look at what that guy's doing.
Yeah.
He's got some swag.
It's impressive.
I'm in on Nate Oates.
Yep.
I am a fan. I like the fact that he's willing to poke and prod and rankle college basketball establishment.
Bill, the confidence is half the battle.
And
when you have somebody like that, it makes for a good program.
And when you're in an outsider like Alabama, who is a football school, quote unquote, and not a basketball school, quote unquote, it takes a little something different to get some attention.
Yeah.
And the style they play and his manner, I think, have drawn some eyes to Alabama. And I don't think they're going anywhere anytime soon unless he leaves. He's building something there that's very impressive. In terms of building programs, we will start to wrap up with this. Loyola Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And their progression here, beating Illinois and looking really good doing it, you know, pretty much looking like the number one seed instead of the number eight seed in that game. The job that Porter Moser has done at Loyola Chicago at a mid-major, to be in the Final Four in 2018, to be two wins away from the Final Four again as we sit here in 2021, it's just fantastic. It really is. It's the closest thing we've seen to Brad Stevens since he was at Butler. That's the easy, lazy comparison. But they do it in similar ways. It's defensive. It's non-negotiable. You know, it's just sweat equity. You know, it's unshakable belief. You get guys like Cameron Krutwig and Lucas Williamson who played on that Final Four team, and you can just feel the belief that they've instilled in their teammates. It's almost like Tom Brady in Tampa this year and Gronk in Tampa, just that ethic and how it bleeds through the locker room. Hey, guys, we've done this. It's the NCAA tournament. It's no big deal. We're a good team.
Absolutely.
We're just going to go out and play. Who cares if they're Illinois and we couldn't recruit Kofi Coburn and we couldn't recruit Ayo Dosunmu? We're going to beat those guys. We're better. We play better basketball than those guys. I'm so impressed. And you know, this isn't some cute little Sister Jean story anymore now. This is a program that potentially, depending on how this offseason goes, could take a step up into the big leagues.
Juan, and it brings you to pause to say, okay, you know, Porter Moser has done what he's done, and the program is where it's at again. So when bigger offers, bigger schools like in Indiana come along and say, Porter, we want you to, you know, lead our program and we want you to steer it in the right direction. Does he go or does he stay at Loyola Chicago, continue to build on what they have, try to get more resources and try to, you know, make them an establishment in their conference and in their area and recruiting and everything that goes along with it? It's an interesting decision. Money is money. I'm sure a big school will throw a big contract toward, you know, Porter Moser. And he's going to have, I think, at some point, a decision to make. Could be this offseason with a school like Indiana. Could be, you know, some other time. But, you know, that you pause and you think about it more because this isn't a one-year. You know, I think when Andy Enfield took Florida Gulf Coast to the Final Four, you know,
Sweet 16.
Sweet 16.
Goodness, that would have been a start.
Yeah, right. Sorry. when he takes them there, you know, he got the offers that, you know, to go to USC like that, to immediately go to a big program, I think it was a no-brainer for him. But, you know, for Loyola Chicago, can they continue to do this? Can they keep this going? Can they put more resources into it? I don't know.
that's what coaches weigh in terms of making the jump. If you consider Porter Moser's career in coaching, he was fired at Illinois State. He took a job on Rick Majerus' staff at St. Louis as an assistant. He ultimately got hired by Loyola Chicago to be the head coach. His first 6 years at Loyola Chicago, which were before the Final Four, he's under 500 in four of them. So you look at it and you think, you know, how much time was he given? You know, how much did they really see themselves as a basketball program that could compete with elite programs in the country? The answer is probably not that much, you know, because generally if you think that you are supposed to be at a certain level in basketball, you don't give your coach that much time. Archie Miller just got fired in 4 years at Indiana, didn't make an NCAA tournament,
right?
You know, was paid a $10 million buyout to go away. Indiana expects better. You know, Loyola Chicago might not necessarily expect better. They might have looked at Porter Moser and said, he's a good man, he runs a clean program, he graduates his players, let's stick with him. All of a sudden, lightning strikes, and you're in the Final Four in his seventh season. Since then, the last four, they've won 99 games. They've won three out of the last four Missouri Valley regular season titles. That is the power program in that league now, along with Drake.
Yeah.
Wichita State going to the American sort of opened it up for somebody else to step through, and Loyola has done that. And you might look and you might say, well, they play in the Missouri Valley. Can they realistically sustain this going forward? Gonzaga did it in the West Coast Conference. So it depends on how much you're willing to invest, how much you're willing to advance Porter Moser's program in terms of, you know, are you going to give him the chance to schedule nationally? You know, are they going to be able to get into these exempt events in Florida or in Hawaii, you know, or in the Bahamas? Are they going to get invited to these two-game showcases in Madison Square Garden and in Brooklyn? You know, are you going to capitalize on maybe that name brand? You know, you're the Ramblers, and here's Sister Jean, and here's Porter Moser. How much can you sustain and maximize that momentum? I think that the university's vision for that and how they lay it out for him is going to be hugely influential in whether or not he stays or whether or not he starts to itch for a bigger stage. You know, the other thing I think you would look at is Loyola Chicago is an 8 seed this year. They were 9 in KenPom. The 8 schools ahead of them got the 1s and the 2 seeds. So is there a glass ceiling in the NCAA in terms of how successful will they allow us to be?
Yeah.
Are they constantly going to seed us in the middle of the field, even if the math says otherwise? They're the number 2 defense in the country, 2 in offensive rebounds against, 6th in fouls against. They play elite defense. And people would look and say, well, they play in the Missouri Valley. The competition isn't as good. You wouldn't do that if he was at Wisconsin. Those numbers are based on possession by possession. They're not based on your team, your talent, where your guys were recruited. They're based on how well you actually play basketball.
Sure.
That is an elite team. That's similar to what Butler was doing in their 2 Final Four appearances under Brad Stevens. You know, Butler was a top 10 defense one of those years. I think they were top 50-ish in another year. But you could see how non-negotiable it was at that end, how they bumped off cutters, how physical they were. The fact that they got Gordon Hayward was a huge bonus for Brad Stevens.
Sure.
He put them on the map. But
yeah, I'd love to see them play that kind of defense in Boston. Anyway.
But that ethic, that way of playing, it was established. It has been established now mm-hmm. at Loyola Chicago. There's no reason to think that Porter Moser can't take it forward. It's just a matter of how easy are they going to make it for him? How sustainable are they going to make it for him? You know, and what sort of other offers might intrigue him?
Yeah. Oh, it's all, absolutely. It's about what he hears from the outside and what resources could be provided for him going forward. That's what it's always about with these sorts of programs. But you know, is it possible for him to keep this going? And as Bill said, you know, off the mic here, could they become the Gonzaga of the Midwest? You know, maybe. Maybe they could. But it's about, you know, there's going to be a lot of circumstances that determine what happens going forward. But it's a great discussion to have because it's great to see a program like that, you know, not only on the stage that it was a few years ago, but back here and having consistent success the last few years.
One potential landing spot for Porter Moser was taken off the board this morning. Shaka Smart is going to Marquette.
Ooh.
Leaving Texas and going home to Wisconsin. He is a Madison native. Shaka Smart coming to the Big East. Lost, obviously, in the first round of the NCAA tournament with Texas to Abilene Christian. He leaves the Longhorns with no NCAA wins. 52 and 56 in the Big 12. 109 and 86 overall. This is a really interesting decision by him that I think you could take a look at from a lot of angles. The first, obvious one, is was he pursuing a soft landing here? Did he perceive that he might be in trouble at Texas? If not now, maybe next year. Did he look at Marquette as a job in a really good league in his home state that he felt like he'd be able to maximize, do a little better than Steve Wojciechowski, a place that maybe if you make the NCAAs two out of every 3 years, you know, three out of every 4 years, you know, maybe you make a run every once in a while, a Sweet 16, you know, once every 5 years. Maybe your alumni, your boosters will be happy with that. I don't know. He took a big swing going from VCU to Texas. I think a lot of folks would look at it and say that it didn't necessarily work out the way some people might have thought. He didn't necessarily win as big at Texas as might have been expected. So from that sense, maybe a soft landing for him here at Marquette.
I think so. I think so for all the factors you just named. And isn't it a different athletic director at Texas now than the one that hired him? Am I right about that?
I think he was hired by DeLoss Dodds, and, okay. And now I think Chris Del Conte is there. I think he was previously there. He was previously at TCU. I think that's correct.
That tells me that it's one of those new general manager in baseball with a new, you know, skipper or a guy that's in the clubhouse that was there before. Sort of, okay, let's see how it works out. Maybe it's not working out. Maybe he saw writing on the wall. So I think that could also factor into the decision to go, because maybe they were going to, maybe he sniffed that they were going at some point to maybe try to make a change, and that the new, you know, AD was going to, you know, hire sort of his guy or go through his search, you know, to find the next guy. So obviously he's going to have that opportunity now with Shaka going. And Marquette, it's in his home state, as you mentioned. So sort of a job in the Big East. So it's not like you're going to another power conference. So I guess for all the factors that we've just laid out here, it makes sense. It makes sense.
Shaka Smart. Let's see. Shaka Smart was hired by Steve Patterson.
Okay.
Who was only there for 2 years after DeLoss Dodds. His tenure was not a rousing success in Austin. One of the things he did do was hire Shaka Smart.
Yep.
Didn't necessarily work out, the way he might have thought.
And I think before that conference tournament this year, too, you felt like there were sort of the rumblings. And maybe some of the good feelings got better because they go through the conference tournament the way they did. You know, they go in as a three seed in the tournament. Maybe some good feelings there, and then they lose to Abilene Christian, and that sort of, you know, gets dinged a little bit in the armor. So
he was certainly coaching for his job last year. He had them in NCAA position.
Mm-hmm.
As we've seen with Tom Herman at Texas football, money is no object. They can buy out contracts.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever they want. I think the total paid to Tom Herman and staff was somewhere around $24 million.
Holy cow.
To go away. You add on the salary that they're paying to Steve Sarkisian, and you know, you're talking 30, 40, 50 million of commitment. And Texas just bats an eyelash and says, okay, because it is, you know, one of the most funded athletic departments in the nation. You would look at some other circumstances in Texas that might have led Shaka Smart to look elsewhere. And they do involve the football program. And they do involve some reporting by the Texas Tribune, where they took a look at the inner workings of the football program, the relationship between players, boosters, coaching staff, and centers around the school song, The Eyes of Texas, which a lot of folks say has some racial overtones, has some connections to a racial past. There were some sentiments expressed by players that they weren't necessarily comfortable singing that song or being on the field for it. The Texas Tribune obtained emails from boosters to the athletic department threatening to pull their funding for the athletic programs at Texas, some of them racist in nature. Very uncomfortable, some of the sentiments that were expressed there. And so you wonder, Shaka Smart, black man coaching in a predominantly black sport, college basketball, if he felt comfortable continuing there. I don't know if he'd ever publicly address that. I don't know if that's something that he'd feel comfortable getting into. But I wonder if maybe, his standing, his position as the head men's basketball coach at Texas, if that was a place that he wanted to represent going forward.
I think it's a fair thing to bring up, Bill. I think it's a fair thing to bring up. And especially with the suddenness of, the timing of it. And it's like, wow, okay. Everybody looked at it this morning and said, wow, he's leaving Texas, he's going to Marquette. Like, wow, that's interesting. And we think of all the factors, and maybe that's just, it's an uncomfortable factor that you don't want to, I guess, bring up. But I think it's fair to bring up. And I'm with you. I don't think he would address it publicly, because I don't think it's something that he would, I think privately, it's probably something that he's talked about and discussed and talked about, I'm sure, with his family and whatnot. But, I bet you in some percentage of form, I think it played into it. Sure.
It's, as we've talked about before, it's something that we wish we didn't have to discuss in 2021 in America. But
it needs to be.
It needs to be discussed based on what's happened in this country recently and some of the things that... some Shaka Smart's players have gone through, and some of the athletes of Texas have gone through, and certainly, some of the folks that we know, whether they be coaches, players, or whatnot. And there's certainly things that, as we've said before on the podcast, you and I might not face, but we cannot be ignorant to the fact that those things are out there.
Absolutely.
And that we do have a responsibility to at least have the uncomfortable conversations that might come into play when something on the surface as sudden, as surprising like this happens. And so Shaka Smart going to Marquette, I would say that further elevates the profile of the Big East.
Exciting.
There's a guy who's a Final Four coach, who was a serial NCAA coach at VCU, someone who at VCU played a very trademark style of basketball, Havoc, being trademarked by the school, still marketed by the school to great effect. So you wonder how that might shake up the balance of power in the Big East. You look at Villanova and Creighton in the Sweet 16, Georgetown winning the conference tournament, UConn making the tournament, resurgent UConn returning to the Big East. You wonder what all that means for Providence, for Seton Hall, for Butler. And that's the sort of intrigue that we're going to get into as we preview next season. It's just fascinating the way that the transfer carousel spins and the way the coaching carousel spins. And really, college basketball, the quote-unquote off-season, doesn't feel like there is one anymore.
Not really. And we have a lot of great teams, intriguing conferences to cover around here, and that's what really makes it fun.
No question about it. We will reconvene at some point soon. Ideally, we will get together with another three-man weave after all this is over. And rehash just how badly we did on our brackets. Coit and I have given ourselves a little bit of abuse here over the last 90 minutes. Certainly have been honest with you folks about our failings and a few of our successes. We hope you all are doing a little better than we are in your respective pools. I'm certain we share this with all of you. We can't wait for the games to start again this weekend. So with that, Coity, thank you very much as always.
Thanks, buddy.
And folks, thanks for listening.